The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 26th of October 2020 on Monocle 24. The Briefing brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show:
a lot of what we've done over the last 4 years will be undone sooner or later by the next election. They won't be able to do much about this for a long time to come.
U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell appears to admit defeat in next week's presidential election while gloating over an imminent new Conservative Supreme Court justice. Also ahead, as Melbourne emerges from lockdown while Spain returns, a look at what the world has learned about tackling COVID-19. We'll catch up with the latest business news and...
I generally avoid organised recreational activities, but I accepted your invitation in the high-minded hope of increasing my knowledge and appreciation of New York City's built environment.
A letter from New York. That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Later today, if US Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's predictions prove accurate, the US Senate will vote to confirm Amy Comey Barrett to the US Supreme Court. Barrett will be the third judge that the Republican Party has been able to put on the bench during President Donald Trump's term, and while she may not be the controversial of these herself, her confirmation is. The Republicans have breezily disregarded the convention which they invoked 4 years ago to keep a Barack Obama nominee from even having confirmation hearings. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Chris Chermak, Monocle's news editor, and Clodagh Harrington, Associate Professor of American Politics at De Montfort University. Clodagh, first of all, is this now actually a done deal? Is there the remotest chance at all Barrett doesn't get put on the bench?
I think it's all but a done deal. She seems to be there. It's quite staggering to see how fast the process can move when people actually want it to, unlike the last time around, as you mentioned just a moment ago. So, yeah, I would say unless there's some unanticipated catastrophe, she's in.
I mean, Chris, the Republicans' hypocrisy here is mildly staggering. This is, of course, the same Republican Party that 4 years ago clutched its pearls and affected vapors at the very idea of even holding confirmation hearings for Merrick Garland, who Barack Obama wished to put on the court in the last year of his presidency. They're going to do this about a week out from a presidential election. But this is, isn't it, what justifies the Trump thing in the, as far as the Republican establishment is concerned?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the issue is if you look at this from a purely political perspective, taking out the hypocrisy argument, if you will, Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate have achieved exactly what they wanted to achieve. And they have given those people who voted for Donald Trump essentially what they wanted. I think you can divide those who voted for Donald Trump in 2016 obviously into many different camps, but there were those who voted for Trump himself, but then there were many who simply voted for a Republican with this in mind, with the idea in mind that they would be able to influence the Supreme Court for decades to come. Remember, as you said at the beginning, Obama was denied a nominee. That meant that there was a vacant spot open right when Donald Trump was elected president, which was then filled. And that in itself would have been a dramatic swing in the other direction. So we shouldn't forget that. It was a very conservative justice in Antonin Scalia who had passed away or, you know, shortly before the 2016 election. So we have seen a dramatic shift in the court compared to what would have happened if Hillary Clinton had been elected president. And so in that sense, yes, from a purely political perspective, the Senate, Mitch McConnell, who is a traditional Republican, was, you could argue, very much a power political individual who was willing to stomach Donald Trump and some of his politics because he knew that this is what he would be able to achieve.
Clodagh, once Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed, that will give the Supreme Court a 6-3 conservative majority. Now, that's not absolutely set in stone. Supreme Court justices have been known to have minds of their own from time to time. But is it possible from this distance to assess what difference that could make to American politics for, as Chris quite rightly points out, potentially decades ahead of us?
Yes, I think that that's absolutely not an overstatement to say how significant this is. You know, there will be an ideologically conservative majority from this point on. There's a couple of things, I suppose. One is what it might mean in terms of what's coming before the court, you know, in the short to medium term. I mean, there are big issues coming down the road, things on climate change, on immigration, other major sort of political stumbling blocks. The one that's coming soonest, really, and the one that's going to get the most attention for the moment is a vote on the Affordable Care Act. That is coming before the court in November. And it's about rather the statute in its entirety is to be deemed unconstitutional, or you know, can parts of it be unpicked. Now, Coney Barrett's take on this is going to be enormously important because there is a possibility that Obamacare in its entirety could be undermined, and that's a fairly enormous moment, I think, for the country, not least when it's in the grip of a public health crisis.
Chris, at the top of the show, we did play a quote by Senator McConnell, which did strike me as slightly odd. I don't know whether he misspoke or just found himself saying the quiet part out loud, but he said a lot of what we've done over the last 4 years will be undone sooner or later by the next election. Is that Mitch McConnell assuming or perhaps even hoping that Trump gets beaten next Tuesday?
It was an interesting remark, wasn't it? It's hard to say. I think there might be a little bit of that in his remark that you can read into it. I do think more importantly, though, his comment related to what I was saying earlier, I would argue, that he is making this case almost a gloating case to say you can undo whenever you win, whether it is in November, as the polls suggest currently, or not. You can undo much of what we did in the 4 years in electoral terms, in legislative terms, I should say. But you cannot undo what we've done on the court. That will remain, and that will remain something that stays for a long period of time. The one thing I just wanted to say on that as well, I think it will be interesting with this conservative majority to really see how aggressively they go after that. To Mitch McConnell's point, if you will, things like the Affordable Care Act, they were passed by Congress. If there is a Democratic president with Joe Biden becoming president, they will have an opportunity to pass laws to change laws as well, of course. So the question really will be to what extent this court goes after laws declaring things unconstitutional versus giving Congress an opportunity to sort of legislate when it comes to things like health care as well. There were some interesting remarks I just add for Amy Coney Barrett on this in the past. She's talked about the idea of precedent, the idea of who legislates when you overturn precedent. And she did have a little bit of a line to say she will only overturn precedents if there is still controversy in a certain issue. So if it is something that is divisive and it has not been decided, if there is an overwhelming public support for something, she also believes that it's not the court's job to overturn it. And so that, I think, will be a key thing to watch going forward if we have, say, a Democratic president, a Democratic majority, but a conservative court.
Clodagh, if next Tuesday is a big win for the Democratic Party, as Senator Mitch McConnell appears to think it's going to be, they're not completely without options. There is the possibility, as has been floated, of expanding the Supreme Court. But do you think a Democratic administration would be willing to spend political capital doing that?
Yes, it's interesting to see how the kind of the tightrope that Biden has been walking in his language on this topic. You know, any mention of packing the court does raise alarm bells, I think, and causes some concern. And people start talking about FDR and his efforts back in the day. I would say maybe there might be and possibly needs to be a conversation about reforming court, because in its current guise, having become such a political body, it's certainly not what the framers set out for it to be. And that there's probably, you know, some serious conversations that need to be had. I suppose there's one other point as well, maybe just more immediately, is that the last male liberal on the court, Stephen Breyer, is aged 82. So, I mean, he seems in relatively good shape, but it's quite likely that whoever is president in the next 4 years will have the opportunity to put a new justice on the court. So that's just something to think about in terms of the balance.
Clodagh Harrington and Chris Chermak, thank you both for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. Here is Monocle's Yolene Goffin with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. Chileans last night voted in favour of redrafting the country's constitution. Around 78% of voters chose to get rid of the current constitution, written in 1980 by dictator General Pinochet, and replace it with a new charter drafted by a committee of elected citizens. Both sides have accused the other of breaking a U.S.-brokered ceasefire in the contested region of Nagorno-Karabakh. Azerbaijan claims Armenian forces proceeded with the shelling of civilian settlements shortly after the ceasefire went into effect, while Armenia claims that the ceasefire was actually broken by Azerbaijani artillery attacks on the Armenian front line. Spain has adopted a state of emergency in a bid to stem the second wave of the coronavirus pandemic after registering over 1 million new infections last week. The government will seek to extend the state of emergency to 6 months. It grants regional authorities the power to impose an overnight curfew, limit gatherings, and, if necessary, impose full or partial lockdowns. And today's Monocle Minute reports on the growing importance of urban farming. For more on this story, head to monocle.com/minute or pick up the new November issue of Monocle magazine. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Yolene. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now, there is, as there always is, good news and bad news where the COVID-19 pandemic is concerned. In Australia, Melbourne is set to begin cautiously reopening after enduring what will have been 112 days of one of the world's more hardcore lockdowns. It seems to have worked. No new cases of COVID-19 were recorded over the weekend. In Spain, however, a state of emergency has been declared, including a national overnight curfew, which Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has warned may last 6 months. On the latest edition of the Foreign Desk, we looked at what we've learned about COVID-19 so far. I spoke to Dr. Chris Smith, Monocle 24's health and science correspondent and a virologist at Cambridge University, and Dr. Margaret Harris of the World Health Organization. Among other things, we discussed what seemed to have gone wrong this European summer.
I think they got the wrong message. The message they got was, oh, we're across the finish line, let's celebrate. And you can understand that. They went through a very difficult time and they put in extraordinary efforts. They really worked together. There was a strong sense of solidarity and they felt great. You know, this is an achievement. Now, the problem was, and I, you know, we've all said it, but it hasn't come through strongly enough. What needed to happen then, and we at WHO even put out guidance saying, look, when you're coming out of your lockdown, you've got to do it stepwise and you've got to understand that you live differently after your lockdown. And that's the difficulty, that we're having to learn steps to this new dance and we don't even have the clear steps. We have to create those steps and do it well together so that we can live in a way that allows us to have an economic life, a social life, a less distressing life, and also our health system can get on with doing all the other things it's there for, dealing with all the other illnesses. So indeed, you don't have large numbers of people dying from other things because they simply couldn't get the health care that would normally be a given. So what was missed in the summer was the opportunity to really develop that way of living, adapt to that way of living to prevent this resurgence now. Let's hope that people have got the message now and we get through this winter living with COVID, learning this new dance and finding a way to live as well as we can and as safely as we can.
Just to follow that up, though, Margaret, in terms of messaging in particular, are you noticing any governments, whether they're national ones or regional ones, who successfully got to grips with certainly what strikes me as the key problem here is that people are just really bored with this?
I think I'd point you to East Asia, that many countries, now you've referred to Vietnam, but I can also think of Hong Kong, I can think of Korea, countries that have had quite a big outbreak and dealt with it and have had small spikes and dealt with it each time. And I think the difference there is all of them have had a significant infectious diseases outbreak already. Hong Kong saw SARS, the first SARS. Vietnam also saw SARS. We lost one of our epidemiologists investigating that SARS in Vietnam. But Korea had MERS in 2015, and they had a very bad outbreak, and they had to learn a lot of pretty tough lessons during that time. These are societies that know what an infectious disease outbreak can do to you. I would also point to Africa. People have been like, how come Africa's doing so much better? And in many ways, it's because, again, the people of Africa know what an infectious disease outbreak can do to you and take it a lot more seriously.
Chris, did we here in Europe learn anything at all from the Sweden experiment? Sweden was something of an outlier in terms of its response. It didn't just wave the thing off and declare business as usual, but it didn't lock down as hard or as fast as, well, basically all of its neighbours did, certainly at the start of the pandemic. They certainly seemed to pay for that initially with a much higher death toll and much higher infection rates, certainly compared to their neighbours. But was there any kind of useful path cleared there?
Anders Tegnell, who is the lead for the public health implementation of their strategy in Sweden, has acknowledged that their strategy is not perfect. And one of the things they acknowledge is that in the same way in the UK, the failure to protect care homes was the big mistake. And the reason it was a big mistake is that it meant that the virus gets into that environment and spreads like wildfire. And you've got a whole cohort of very vulnerable people who are absolutely dependent on carers. So carers bring the virus in, or visitors, and then the people who are care home residents who catch it then pass it on to each other. Or, as was also the case, hospitals were cleared in a hurry to make space for the anticipated huge surge of coronavirus cases that we thought was coming, which didn't materialise, actually. And many of that space and capacity was created in healthcare services by sending people from the hospital who had coronavirus but weren't necessarily picked up into care homes where they stimulated these enormous outbreaks. Now, had that not happened, and it happened in Sweden, it happened in the UK, the death toll would have been very, very different. Now, it's very easy to be extremely wise in retrospect, and one must be very cautious of using what we dub in medicine as our retrospectoscope, where we look very pleased with ourselves and wise by benefit of hindsight effect. But at the same time, yes, Sweden have taken a different, interesting approach. They have been more relaxed about some aspects of what they've done. Their economy has taken less of a hit so far than, say, the UK economy has. But as Maggie de Blok, who is the Belgian health minister, has said, no one across Europe counts COVID the same way. And what she's getting at is one must be very careful about making comparisons between countries, for instance, across Europe, not just in terms of COVID rates, but in anything. Because if you look at the population of Sweden, it's measured in single numbers of millions. In fact, you could get the entire population of Sweden on the London Underground and move them around in an entire day, which is what the London Underground would normally be doing at peak. And that's just one country's population in just one city's public transport system. the population density in Sweden is very different than the population density of the UK. The number of people who are living in single occupancy housing in Sweden is very different than the number of people who are living in single occupancy housing in the UK, in the wrong direction for us in the UK. And as a result, there are many, many differences between these different geographies and these different jurisdictions. And therefore, what works in one place may well work in another, but it may well not. And you've got to be very careful before saying that works there, let's just apply it.
Margaret, this has, of course, been a massive challenge in public health messaging. But in this particular case, it's a particularly difficult one when it comes to messaging young people, who I think are probably the cohort least susceptible to official messaging. They are certainly, at least so far, among the cohorts least susceptible to COVID-19. And they're the ones who most want to go out and do all the stuff that you're really not supposed to be doing. How do you get this message about the new way of living across to them?
You're quite right. One of the really tricky things about this particular virus is who it affects most severely. So everybody gets infected, but some people get a great deal more ill than others. Getting that message across that it may not be a problem for you, but it will be a big problem for others was difficult. Also, the message like, have a terrible life, stay indoors all the time, don't have any fun because you might infect someone else. That's quite a tough one. Having said that, young people, old people, most people have a core of decency and are willing to help if it's made clear how they can help. It would have been more effective if we'd found ways to enable young people to have a decent social life without being shut down in lockdowns, or to ask them, okay, how can we do this? How can we live more safely but enjoyably? What can you do? So we haven't seen enough of that bottom-up communication, that what do you think we should be doing better?
That was Dr. Margaret Harris and Dr. Chris Smith. You can hear that interview in full and more besides by downloading the latest edition of The Foreign Desk just as soon as you're done listening to this. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. We'll be back shortly.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering, to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller. Time now to take a look at the latest business news. I am joined, as usual, to do exactly that by Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Ewan, first of all, more details today of the biggest share offering ever.
Yeah, Jack Ma's Ant Group is to raise $34 billion from a dual listing in Shanghai and Hong Kong. Now, the company is the owner of Alipay, which I'm sure you know, Andrew, is the world's most important online payments platform. I think to call it the PayPal of China would be rather to do it a disservice, but it's the world's most valuable startup company. After the listing, Ant is likely to be valued at about $280 billion. Now, some might say it's a rather brave time to launch a share offering, what with the US election next week. A lot of investors concerned about volatility, particularly if we get a contested election result in the middle of next week. But it looks like this share offering is going to go off to a pretty good start. The first tranche of shares offered to institutional investors was oversubscribed 284 times. So it looks like it's going pretty well over in China.
Today is not off to a spectacular start on European share markets, but it's off to an especially unspectacular one for SAP in Germany.
Yeah, it's Europe's biggest software company. Its shares dropping as much as 21% today. That's the biggest intraday drop for the shares since 1999, wiping 28 billion euros from SAP's market value. Now, the German software company is known for its enterprise software. It's cut its revenue forecast for the full year, and it says that it expects a fresh wave of lockdowns to hurt demand through the first half of 2021. It's a rare bit of bad news for the tech sector. We've spoken on Monocle before about how the sector has been doing very well in 2020. Facebook, Amazon, Netflix and Google have all seen their shares rallying over the course of this year, in contrast to many other sectors which have been hit during the pandemic. But SAP saying that they're seeing a drop-off in cloud revenue. This is pointing to a sign that companies are putting off making major decisions about updating their software as the pandemic continues to limit the economic recovery. SAP is saying that it's moving expectations for meeting its 2023 strategy right out to 2025. It says that these new lockdowns coming in across parts of Europe are really starting to hit demand. So it'll be interesting to watch out to see if this is the start of a new trend of companies warning about the economic effects of these new lockdowns.
Ewan Potts at Bloomberg, thank you very much as always for joining us. This is The Briefing on Monocle 24, and we do like our international network of journalists to keep us abreast of the cultural life of the cities in which they live. So when our acting New York City correspondent Henry Rhys Sheridan told us he was going on an architectural scavenger hunt around the city, we were sure to commission a report from him, and this is what he sent us.
Last week, a friend invited me to form a team with her to compete in an architectural scavenger hunt. I generally avoid organised recreational activities, but I accepted her invitation in the high-minded hope of increasing my knowledge and appreciation of New York City's built environment. We downloaded a list of culturally significant sites across the city. Our mission was to take a photograph of ourselves in front of as many of them as possible over the course of a weekend. I arrive at my friend's house on Saturday afternoon. Stepping into her car, I am confronted with the unwelcome presence of her dog, Monk. I've got a low opinion of Monk. He either can't or won't play fetch. In the park, his social interaction with other dogs is limited to half-hearted anus sniffing. And to cap it off, he has a haughty deportment that is, in my opinion, indecorous. In short, he harshes my mellow, and I can't help but suspect that I harsh his in turn. Also, today his breath is particularly foul. I should have brushed his teeth, my friend appeals, eager to assume the blame for her mongrel's halitosis. It's fine, I lie, inwardly adding the stench to my mental list of the hound's shortcomings. We set off on a long drive to the Bronx. Our first target is the grave of pioneering American feminist Elizabeth Cady Stanton in Woodlawn Cemetery. Wait, says my friend, we need a mascot. I remember that we are required to hold some kind of object in each scavenger hunt photo we submit for obscure verification purposes. But we haven't decided on one yet. Luckily, the boot of my friend's car can be relied upon to contain an ample pile of extraneous crap. Rummaging ensues. There's a gatefold vinyl house record. Too culturally specific, the judges will think we're making some kind of veiled political statement. There's a set of car seat covers that are for some reason not on the car's seats, but formlessly piled into its boot. But they're too big and flappy. I've got it, says my friend, emerging from the car's passenger side footwell with a hip flask. The flask is a bit small and dark, and we're concerned it might not show up in the photos. So we tuck a bright yellow kerchief commemorating a baby shower into its cap to increase the flask's visibility. It looks a bit like the flask is wearing an oversized cape. We rapidly locate the target tombstone with the help of some chipper graveyard attendees. The Stanton family monument is handsome, and the setting of Woodlawn Cemetery stately. I try to take it all in, but my friend reminds me that this isn't a sightseeing tour, but instead a goddamned competition, and bundles me back into the car. When I agreed to the scavenger hunt, I pictured myself strolling at a leisurely pace through New York City, a contemporary flaneur casting an urbane eye on its finer structures. But this wasn't what the designers of the scavenger hunt had in mind. The lion's share of the afternoon is spent sitting in traffic in the Bronx, crawling between medium-sized municipal facilities. At each one, we dutifully take a photo of one or both of us brandishing the hip flask while its yellow kerchief cape flaps plaintively in the breeze. By the time we reach Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center, I'm lightheaded from inhaling a cocktail of car exhaust fumes and the even more noxious vapor coming out of Monk's mouth. Even my hyper-competitive friend is losing her enthusiasm for the scavenger hunt. "This is rubbish, we should give up," I say, and after a brief hesitation, she concurs. Relief washes over me in an awesome wave, and I'm reminded of my lifelong love of quitting, especially when something's difficult. We curse the competition's organisers and drive to an Ethiopian restaurant in Morningside Heights, near the campus of Columbia University. We sit outside. My friend has tied Monk to the restaurant's perimeter railings and placed a small plastic bowl of food on the sidewalk for him. Monk has managed to use his snout to nudge the bowl to the end of his own tether and cannot reach it anymore. My friend is sitting with her back to her pet, so I am the only witness to the wretched dog's trial. I choose not to draw her attention to it. Eating delicious Ethiopian food with my hands, having shirked a self-imposed obligation, and watching a despised animal struggle in vain, I am overcome with an enormous sense of well-being.
Henry Rees Sheridan and chuckling canine sidekick in New York City. And that is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Yolin Goffin and Augustin Macellari. Our studio manager today was May Lee Evans. The Briefing returns tomorrow at midday UK time. I'll be your host for that as well. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.